Hi, this is Paul, and I want to talk about the so-called left and the boundaries of sexual ethics. I came across a very interesting conversation on a group that a group was having. I won't mention the group, where they were sort of going back and forth over what's going back and forth with respect to the ongoing conversation about Christianity and the sexual revolution. And one person shared his suspicion that people on the left didn't have a boundary. Now, this to me sort of connects up with Jordan Peterson's, well, when does the left go too far? So then the question is, well, when does the sexual ethic for the left go too far? And so another person responding suggested that people on this particular group should ask five of their friends who they consider on the left to name the boundary of their sexual ethic beyond that of, let's say, consent or consenting adults. So let's just keep it within that frame and see what they said. So a bunch of people went out and emailed, talked to, touched base with some of their friends on the left with respect to the sexual ethic and asked. And the response they got back was a lot of suspicion and hesitation for people. And I read that and I thought, oh, I think I know why. And so, in response to that, I wrote what I wrote here that I'll read here and probably discuss as I go through it. So, besides consenting adults, are there any boundaries for sex on sex for people on the left? Ask your friends. As many noted, that people on the left often balked at the question. There are so many thoughts that here are some thoughts that are about the given post about boundaries. The question is, are there boundaries? Or what are the boundaries? Now, most people probably would say, are there boundaries? Well, I suppose so. Well, what are the boundaries? Well, I wouldn't want to speculate. And I think there are real reasons for that that go far deeper than just the question of sexual boundaries and sexual ethics. Questions about are there boundaries and how are those boundaries enforced are different from the theoretical questions about should there be boundaries. Again, most people would probably say, should there be boundaries? Yes. Are there boundaries? I don't know. How should the boundaries be enforced? Well, now suddenly people get really nervous. Many will say, hypothetically, there should be boundaries. I can't imagine that no boundaries is a good idea. Probably most people would say, yeah, no boundaries is a bad idea. Okay. Because they don't want to say no boundaries hypothetically are a bad idea. But again, we're talking hypothetical. And this is sort of a function of our age. There is skepticism about saying no to people today. I think part of this because so many traditions have been pushed back or found to be untrue in the eyes of many. There is skepticism about eschatology and the telos of sex, again, because so much has been pushed back and labeled as bigotry. So if you ask people what the point of sex is, I think a lot of people, again, more on the left, now that's a guarded statement that I'm going to use for now, but they will say, well, what's the telos? What's the purpose of sex? Well, and then they'll be hesitant to say that. And again, all of this hesitation is because answers that were assumed not very long ago have sort of been undermined, and many of them have been undermined in a particular way. In a previous video, I made the comment that part of what happened in the American Civil Rights Movement was that so many institutions that were identified with traditional positions were exposed on, let's say, the issue of racism. That shift in the American cultural imaginary is so profound that in many cases, people can't even think of the time before the civil rights movement without sort of assuming that everything is tainted. Everything is tainted, and that what the civil rights movement did was begin was this boundary water of purity and good and knowledge that before it, well, everything was tainted, except for maybe some of the good guys that we can identify. I think in some ways, a similar thing has been happening with respect to the conversation around same-sex marriage. And I think we see this dynamic. And what this dynamic actually produces in our culture is skepticism. Second point, you also have the issue with third and first person culturally right now. And I used that instead of sort of the monarchical vision and the first person, which is basically what I'm talking about, which you'll see in a minute. The third person is the main mode of modernity that we might call the imaginary universe. So I imagine I can see the whole universe because it's all there in front of me, or the monarchical vision. I'm at this point where I can see everything as it is. And the vision of science. Science is, of course, the tool by which we can see everything as it is. And it's a declaration that everywhere and always something is true. And science goes out to describe that everywhere and always such and such a thing is true. And this particular approach to knowledge, this approach to making decisions about things is ubiquitous. And science is supposed to provide this. Now, I recently was sent by a very helpful person to this video. So someone sent me this video from Radiolabs. Now, Radiolabs is one of these old school podcasts that way back in the day when there were hardly any podcasts around, I would listen to the Engadget podcast, which would be like sort of my next, and then the Verge podcast. I would listen to those guys. I would listen to Leo Laporte over there at Twitch. I would listen to Unbelievable, and I would listen to Radiolabs. There were like four podcasts that I would listen to, and Radiolabs was one that I listened to quite regularly. Well, quite recently, someone sent me this edition of Born This Way. And I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting because this is one of these little narratives that's been slowly changing underneath the surface and is very identifiable in terms of the demographics.
Hey, I'm Lulu Miller. This is Radiolab. And a little while ago, our reporter, Matthew Kilty, came to me with the story of an idea.
Yeah, the idea that you were born into a sexual orientation.
This is like the Born This Way idea?
Yeah, the Born This Way idea.
Okay.
Which I always believed to be true for much of my life. But in the past few years, that idea felt essentially like under assault. And in these like pretty public ways and ways that were happening on both the right and the left. And so it's like on one hand, you have something like the bill in Florida.
Seven, the parents' rights in education bill.
The don't say gay bill.
The bill prohibits classroom instruction.
Where you can't teach kids third grade and below anything about sexual orientation or gender identity because the logic there.
Now, their selection of setting up is interesting. And I think it's pretty safe to say that Radiolabs is pretty safely on the left. I think we can say that.
Is
so in Florida,
that by talking about sexuality and gender or reading a book about it or whatever,
we will make sure that parents can send their kids to school,
that those things will like change a kid's identity
to get an education, not an indoctrination.
Yeah.
And the foundation of the thing is just this idea that like tiny little things in a kid's school environment is going to change them radically. So that's going on the right.
Uh-huh.
And on the left.
So there are many different theories of gender, and mine is just one.
In the past several years, you've had these ideas that have become much more mainstream. Ideas like how social norms and cultural values and politics and history, how all these things are maybe the most important thing in shaping your own sense of self and your own sexual preferences. That again, like that it's the environment outside you that is really the thing that is making you.
Yeah. I will, I don't know if this matters, but I will just say here that as a queer lady, married to a lady, someone who identifies as bi, and someone who's like read about this stuff and thought about it a fair amount, this is the idea that makes sense to me, that sexuality, that desire, sexuality is shaped by this whole swirl of factors. Like that really makes sense to me. It pretty much lines up with my experience.
Right. And I think, for me, as a cis straight man, my identity always felt very consistent and I just never really had to think about it. And in part, you know, maybe embarrassingly, like I never had to think about it. It was just like I grew up in a world where Born This Way, the Born This Way idea was the thing. It was the thing that I thought you were supposed to believe if you were a good ally to gay rights. It was the thing that you use as an argument against the idea of conversion therapy, that you can just take a kid and, like, change their environment and make them into something. Mm. And it was the thing that I always just, like, vaguely understood to be something rooted in science.
You had a sense you'd been told, like, this is how it works in the science.
Yeah, they're like, the science is at the root of this. And I think I should underline that this is just, like, the Born This Way idea was a thing that millions and millions of people believed.
How do you know that? Like,
well, so I went Googling because I was just like...
And it's a great podcast. I'll put the link below. Listen to the whole thing. You can also obviously find it on your podcast app. And Radiolabs is a major podcast. And I've loved Radiolabs for years. I haven't listened to it for years, but I've loved it for years. But he sets up the conversation, and he notes how, in many ways, Born That Way is a product of, and he walks through the history of it, and then he sort of gets to the end of it, and, well, of course, not only has Born That Way sort of fallen on hard times, but the whole idea that genetics basically determine all of this stuff in us, that too has fallen on hard times. And we've, of course, had Michael Levin around in this little corner adjacent for a while, and you have electroceuticals, and we have all these other things that basically lead us to believe that, okay, genetics certainly are a component, but it was very much overhyped. And as the piece goes on to say, it was basically overhyped for a particular social and political project that sort of came to the fore. It basically was put in place for the sake of gay rights. Now, right away in that, this whole idea of a monarchical vision or your sort of modernist imaginary universe, you would say that, well, for all human beings, this is the case. There's a gay gene, and for all human beings, this is determined, so it's nobody's fault. Now, again, as the conversation progresses, you'll see how people begin to push back on the faultness and say you've simply internalized the idea that same-sex orientation is a malady, and even though you've covered it over and got it out of the DSM, it's a malady, and we have to get that completely off the shelf. And are there norms or aren't there norms beyond consenting adults? And in fact, what would consist of a norm? Now, it's very interesting in that same podcast, when he gets to the Obergefell and he reads it, Justice Kennedy used that that same-sex orientation is normal. And this is where you can begin to sort of peck at words and say, well, wait a minute. Which definition of normal do you mean? Do you mean normal sort of like within bounds, or do you mean like normative? And if you in fact are talking about normative, in what universe of a hierarchy of values is this normative? Normative with respect to what? Are two things equally normative? And so it's an excellent podcast, and I very much do recommend that you listen to it. Now, but part of the monarchical vision, you can watch John Vervaeke's Awakening from the Meaning Crisis and go back to Galileo and a bunch of these things, that basically, in the discarded image, as C.S. Lewis called it, the old way of the universe, you basically had all of us living here on the Earth, which people always say, that the geocentric, well, the Earth wasn't really geocentric because things weren't really so round, as much as the Earth was at the bottom of a stack, and you had like the seven heavens, and of course there's basically a line that starts with the moon, and below that is Earth, and above the moon and beyond is the rest of the cosmos, and you have the ether up there, and you have heavenly bodies and blah blah blah. And so when Satan gets thrown down to Earth, he goes down into the Earth, and they just one step below Hades, hell, which will be even below that. So it's the old view of the universe. Now, of course, one of the big fights that happens in the early modern period is, does the physics that govern this world down here also govern that world below? And so basically what happens in the scientific revolution with all of this discussion about what are the shape of the of the planets and how do they go around and what governs them. Well, now suddenly you have Newtonian mechanics and you have the idea that the same rules of physics apply above and below. And in that way, in many cases, heaven is sort of dispelled. And up goes just into outer space. I talked about that a little bit on my sermon last Sunday, but that's a major shift in terms of sort of the perspective of the world. And C.S. Lewis wrestles with that in The Discarded Image, and many smart people who paid attention to these transitions have noticed it. And these transitions have had a subtle influence on a whole bunch of things. Part of the conquest of this vision was, of course, what Galileo got started when the motion of the heavenly bodies was increasingly seen and proven to follow the laws of the spheres here below. Spheres that he would drop from an Italian tower. Things moved on to what I call the scientistic lab leak, where we imagine that we can speak, define, and map all things according in such terms. And this is what we're doing with respect to sexuality. And in fact, this the idea of ethics and morality also get complexified because, let's say, if your moral system is basically governed by God and his laws, or then you sort of, in a deistic move, talk about natural law because we're just a little bashful to talk about God. We want to be pluralistic. And it's always so funny to me when all the natural law people sort of really start hammering that that's the way it is. It's like, oh, deists, are we? And many of them are. So instead of sort of, you know, instead of God saying, well, thou shalt not, Leviticus 18, thou shalt not do this and that. Now suddenly it's, well, who's to say? Morality must be, let's say, adaptive. And because evolutionary psychology is sort of governing the field right now, it's sort of governing the field. But then, of course, when Andrew Huberman comes around and he is acting like an alpha male, then suddenly people have ethical qualms. Well, I suppose he can sleep with six women, but he has to notify all of them of what he is doing. Oh, and that rule can be found by dropping spheres from towers in Italy? If I drop a sphere from a tower and I say, tell the women about each other or not tell the women about each other, will one of them hit the ground first? Is that how morality works? Is it like that? And so, of course, everything gets much more complex. So the scientistic lab leak basically says, well, we've certainly had a lot of success dropping spheres and starting railroads and launching ocean liners and using steel and doing all this science-y technology stuff. Well, wouldn't it be great if we could have science about human beings? That would be awesome. And maybe that science could tell us what is good and what is bad. And I often see this in the same-sex marriage debate when people step in and they say, well, because of psychology, we know that there's nothing wrong. And it's like, wait a minute. Psychology isn't going to tell you if it's wrong or right in sort of the completely abstract monarchical way. Psychology might tell you that it's maybe helpful or not helpful in terms of pursuing a particular end, but psychology actually has nothing to say about this wrong or right, because in some ways this wrong or right sort of lives in a different world. Because is your wrong or right basically evolutionary psychological, that it's adaptive? Well, and again, I'm not willing to say that there's nothing there, because in sort of a dead reckoning way, there often is something there. It's usually kind of a bad idea to cheat on your wife. And I would make an argument that I think that all things considered, monogamy and enforced monogamy is probably the best system that we've seen. I don't think that's necessarily a difficult thing to say, but again, are there boundaries on sexual ethics for the left? And if so, why? So very quickly, the science-y thing comes in, and without too much more work, you can kind of say, well, science isn't really going to help you out here. So things move on to what I call the scientistic lab leak, where we imagine that we can speak and define and map all things according to such terms. We can create an exhaustive and exclusive map of human sexuality that we can then turn around and read in the third person in order to achieve for ourselves the goals we decide to obtain. Usually some vague sense of the good or fulfillment or authenticity. So in other words, We want to map out human sexuality for human beings. And once it's all mapped territory, now in the third person, we can look at the map and say, okay, if this is the map, now I can apply this to my life to achieve my outcomes. And you see right away, in terms of sort of this perspective, how idolatrous this monarchical vision can really sort of lead us into, because we sort of see ourselves as masters of the universe and we're going to chart our course and we want to define the ends that we think are best. There's deep irony that this imagined capacity has led to skepticism, because we communally believe that such a map is possible, even though everyone will say, sort of, no matter how science-y or how much they disbelieve in God or everything, people say, no, of course we don't have the thing mapped out, but that's just a matter of time. So that becomes science-y, eschatology. Or just a little while, we'll know more. Or just a few years from now, we'll know for certain if these things are good or bad. Again, forgetting that, wait a minute, I'm not really sure your psychology can tell you that. Again, never forget Dr. Melfi and Tony Soprano and the problems that Tony Soprano raised for Dr. Melfi, because she's bumping into those issues. So people will say, well, theoretically, we will map out human sexuality. Okay, when? In my lifetime? Well, probably not. Well, can you put a date on it? No, not really. Okay, well, what picture of maps and the universe are we really getting at here? Because communally, we believe there is that such a map is possible, and that an area, especially like human sexuality, is messy. And so then we say, well, because we haven't really mapped everything out completely, we'll default to skepticism. You say, well, what is mapped out? Well, now, thanks to the civil rights movement and science and the change in the DSM, now we know same-sex behavior is not harmful. Oh, okay, so that's mapped out, you tell me. Okay, well, let's just assume that for now. Let's just assume you got that mapped. Well, now we're going to ask questions why you think that's mapped. And what's really interesting, again, with Born This Way is, well, ask a whole group of people now, a little different from 30 years ago, but ask them now, and people say, Born That Way is mapped out. It's mapped out. Science has told us that same-sex orientation is because of genetics. Now, you get into the podcast and you very quickly learn that even the guy who talked about this and studied this with a study of like 80 men, not women, just men, wasn't even really saying that. But Ted Koppel on Nightline, you know, he sort of leaned into it, and politicians started repeating it. And before you know it, Born That Way was mapped science for us all. And well, some people are born gay, some people are born straight. It's because of their genetics. And so just like we wouldn't have a problem with left-handedness, even though I really don't think we've mapped out right and left-handedness either. Or just like eye color, well, we got a little better genetic grasp on eye color, I think. I don't know. Someone will correct me in the comments, because a lot of smart people. So, but anyway, mapped good enough. And that's where sort of the science-y mapping gets a little funny too. So these maps also tend to be godless, at least in a deistic manner, and the narrative of Genesis 3 is sort of built into them. We imagine that we can map fulfillment. We can say, okay, here's the map of human sexuality. I'm going to chart my course and make my decisions about who I sleep with and who I don't sleep with and who I decide to like, who I don't decide to like, as if our genetics also govern that, fat chance. Or that I have access to all of this genetics. That's always a perpetual problem with sort of this science map. It's always a super theoretical map, because we might say, well, I think that's your genetics that's doing that. But have you actually deconstructed the person's genome? No, but based on what we know from other... Oh, in other words, your real argument for the power of science is that, well, we know all of this. But when it comes down to any given circumstance, what you're probably dealing with are probabilities, not certainty. Well, we're pretty sure of this. And of course, On the news, everyone sounds so certain and sciencey, and we all know this stuff. But when you get to your doctor's office and you say, "Doctor, I don't feel well," and the doctor can't just look at you and say, "This, this, this, let's correct these and off we go." Well, every now and then that works, like with fairly simple stuff. Let's say like a broken arm, that's a fairly clean break. But if you're going into the hospital with an infection or some strange idea of fatigue, or especially if you say you have long COVID or a vaccine injury or Lyme disease or something like this, suddenly everything's out there in the wilderness and the doctors have to sort of admit, yeah, maybe, maybe not. We're doing the best we can with what we got. Oh, so this map really isn't serving the way everyone says it's supposed to serve. It's not that it isn't useful, but it's a little overhyped. So we imagine that we can map a fulfillment course with this map, theoretically, and that if there is any God at all, that God draws a do not cross line in fulfillment. It's sort of like the snake in the garden. You can eat from any tree except that tree. Of course, the serpent comes around and says, "Well, what about that tree? What about that tree? Well, it looks good. Did God really say, what if you tried it? Maybe it won't be so bad. So give it a shot. Go and be a pioneer in terms of fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." Now, many of us are sort of in the middle, believing that God's map for us is a bit too fuzzy too. And our maps have gotten fuzzy. Whereas there's plenty of people on YouTube and all over who will say, "Here is the line. God said it. I agree with it. That settles it." You don't see those bumper stickers like you used to anymore. I would imagine there's still an industry for that. But so again, the thought is that, well, here's the map and God draws lines and says, fulfillment is in this box. That's the telos. That's where the hierarchy. And if you live according to this, well, then, and there's all kinds of things. Well, you'll inherit the kingdom of heaven. You and the rich young ruler. You can do lots of other things. So this, stay in the lines and everything will be fine. Okay. But how fuzzy or not is, of course, the obsession of different groups. Genesis 3, the tree is there. It's mapped, and God says, don't eat it. Now, human sexuality, there are pleasures on the map that can be gained, but the God of the Bible and C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity, by the way, says heterosexual sex acts are for marriage only. Does that mean sex outside of marriage isn't fun? No, it's quite fun, I'm sure. Many people have tried, and many people have testified. Sex outside marriage, lots of fun. Is it a good idea? Well, then suddenly things get complicated. And even the mappings get really complicated. What do you mean by good idea? Good idea for who? Good idea when? Where? How? Why? So according to this box by God and C.S. Lewis, I mean, everything else is ruled out. Now, there are plenty of ways of dealing with this, involving redefining a bunch of things. Well, is it common law marriage? Is it? So you can go on and on. And often what people do is sort of use things like health and harm. These two H words will come up very regularly in the conversation. And they're intended to predict mappings without going into detail, details that are used to circumvent. So, well, if we find an area of sexual activity that's not within the box, and it doesn't prove to be harmful, well, then maybe we should remap. Maybe we read God wrong. Maybe, because, you know, you look at the sex lives of the patriarchs, there's a lot of people in the Bible who are by no means staying within those boundaries, and it doesn't necessarily look like it's always bad, ever. I mean, just look at all of the tribes of Israel that are the products of concubines and slavery, okay? Right there it is. Jacob has two wives, they're sisters, that's outside the bounds, and two concubines, they're slaves. Maybe that's not outside the bounds in the Bible, but it's outside the bounds for us. So already there's a lot of complexity. Now, not too long ago, I made a video on the Andrew Huberman dust-up. And as is usually the case, other people said a lot smarter things than I did. Ross Douthat of the New York Times writes a piece, March 27, 2024, The Quest for a New Vision of Sexual Morality. Someone's calling me. I can't answer right now. I'm making a video. The death of Hugh Hefner and the dawn of the Me Too era coincided with the autumn of 2017, seemed to mark a turning point in the history of social liberalism in America. Out at last, when Hefner's sex-positive utopianism, the no-prudence, prudishness, giddiness, and aspirational promiscuity that linked his Playboy philosophy to 1980s sex comedies, 1990 Lad magazines, not quite sure what those are, liberal excuses for Bill Clinton's, I'm not sure what that word is, and sweeping cultural triumph of pornography. In came the hashtag MeToo feminism, founded on outrage over rape and sexual assault, but inclined much more broadly to regard hookup culture as a danger zone, male desire as a force in need of correction and control, and bare consent as insufficient criterion for sexual morality. So therefore, well, maybe the left does think that there's a boundary, but will it name one? Can it name one? And if not, why not? We're going to get to that in a little bit. So Ani goes and writes about that, and then suddenly Andrew Huberman, pop neuroscientist, podcaster, and all-around male influencer. And this woman basically, yes, as a lifestyle guru and medical guru, don't trust the effectiveness of the supplements. A friend and colleague, don't expect him to make good on his promises. And especially as a boyfriend and lover, he controls, he lies, he cheats, six women at once. The portrait of a figure like Huberman would be interesting under any circumstances, but the special force of his sex life, the detailed testimony from alleged mistreated girlfriends, marks this as very much a post-Me Too profile. Huberman is not accused of any sexual crime. He seems just creepy, cheaty, and controlly. Those are my words. Douthat writes much better. But that kind of misbehavior is treated as essential to any judgment in his public career. Whatever the new rules of sex might be, it's clear that we're supposed to judge the cad's lifestyle as regressive, deplorable, and wicked. So what kind of lifestyle would be preferable? Well, he points out that, well, New York Magazine just had a thing on polyamory that seemed fairly approving. When Huberman's profile appeared, some social media voices suggested that there's a tension in publishing a takedown of a man juggling six girlfriends after celebrating the juggle just a couple of months before. But of course, people jumped in and said, no, he's lying. Oh, so lying and consent, those are the two things? So lying is, no, we seem to be getting quite Jordan Peterson-ish here. Don't lie, or tell the truth, or at least don't lie. That idea of sex as process, with the sexual act itself embedded inside the kind of best practices of dialogue and interaction, seems to be where social liberalism has settled for now in its attempt to create a post-Hefnerian sexual culture. Thus, the general fascination with polyamory, manifest in trend pieces, books, and essays too numerous to count, isn't just about envelope pushing and shock value. It also reflects a desire to maintain the permissive sexual ethic that men like Hefner turn to their own exploitative ends. But to make it healthier and therapeutic, more female-friendly and egalitarian, safer and more structured. So, hey, polyamory, that's the way to go. However, a glance at some actual human relationships should raise some more doubts about how well this model really works. Whatever Huberman's failures of honesty and communication, for instance, he appears extremely well-versed in the kind of therapy speak that's supposed to tame libidinous excess. suggesting that predators and cads can work through this system as well as any other. Because after all, evolutionary psychologically, Huberman is just there to sow his seed, even though another level of his consciousness is interrupting the seed sowing, and he's just kind of making sure the seed doesn't get embedded and fruit gets formed. And Huberman doesn't want to have 30 kids by the time he's 45. Well, he wasn't really what he was until just a few years ago, when now he's got access to all kinds of women he didn't used to have access to. But at least the sowing seed part, you know, it's basically like, despite evolutionary psychology, men are like tractors. And they just like driving around the field, running their plows, but, you know, they're not dropping any seed. Grim Grizz will have a field day with this one. Or again, the new Mom with an Open Marriage memoir by Molly Rodden Winter Moore reads like a testament to marital suffering than any guide to the good life. Doesn't surprise me. And so basically where Douthat goes with this is he says, well, you know, and then, of course, the transgender thing will have to come into play. The social liberalism cannot simply promise what it's been trying to offer since the Me Too shift, an absolute form of individual freedom wrapped in a protective carapace, there's a nice word, of expert management and therapeutic processes. And that's, in fact, what, well, here's the map. Well, okay, so we don't have the whole map now. But what we know that is if you sort of read the right liberated people and go to the right therapist and watch the right movies, you can sort of weave your way through the world and achieve. But again, we've never really even dealt with the telos. At least you can look back over the fields that you've sown without seed, or the men who you've allowed to sow you, or any combination in between, and say, yeah, I did pretty good. No. Come on, we're maxers. We want to do better than pretty good. We want to look back over our fields and say, I had the best sowing, non-sowing possible. My... So we're just doing a Luke's live stream this morning.
And it's done through love, which is sacrifice. So it's where Eros and Agape meet.
And we want everyone on here to know that all of these five gentlemen are very good at the sex. Just let's make that clear. And Tweebus, if you say anything about this, I will find you.
Oh my goodness.
I'm still laughing. Luke's timing was perfect. Let's get back on track. What she was attacking in the name of a more radical liberation is the way that youth transitioning has been presented to the public across the last decade as a matter of certain settled science, as a therapeutic best practice backed up by careful study and trustworthy expertise, in which the fraught, life-altering desire of a teenager can be granted so long as the right safeguards are in place. Thus runs in parallel telling to the way that polyamory is often presented as the safe kind of liberation, the therapist-approved form of promiscuity, with the potential risks and regrets more limited than they would be if the individual libido were simply given rein. The problem with this presentation in the case of transgender issues is that the institutions of liberal expertise in Western Europe especially are increasingly doubtful about the scientific therapeutic structure in which the transitioning is taking place. The science isn't actually settled. The safeguards aren't necessarily effective. The decision to stop puberty or proceed with surgical modification carries all kinds of unsurprising risks. In other words, what that means is, well, eschatologically, we assume by virtue of the faith that we have in our certain religion that we don't accept as it being a religion, says that, well, someday we'll know, and so today we'll go on the best map contours we have possible. But of course, when you see something as radical as born that way going away, suddenly all the sciencey stuff starts getting a little mushy. And then people will tend to look, in terms of practicality, at, well, all of these studies, and the studies proliferate, and again and again and again, if you just listen to podcast studies, as if it's the word of God, the word of God, the word of God, the word of God, the word of God. Well, yeah, religion is at work here. And so born that way, mostly male studies, and then suddenly female studies come along and genetic science continues to develop, and all of these epigenetics and the electrical life of the cells and all of these things come around, and suddenly, well, it's skepticism again, and our maps just suddenly got a whole lot blurrier. And then what makes perfectly reasonable sense is that people who don't have endless numbers of hours to actually do research in any one particular thing because their life touches endless amounts of non-siloed wisdom and guidance that you need just to make your one individual life work. One thing you do in terms of, say, getting a rush, a quick fix on, well, where should I go and what should I, well, maybe let's look to the past. And suddenly tradition and religion are back on the menu because nobody's done all the science for everything and all the decisions I have to make in any individual day of my life. Therefore, maybe I'll trust the religion and the tradition more than I'll trust the science, because COVID gave us all a lesson in trusting the science. In which case, social liberalism cannot simply promise what it's being trying to offer since this hashtag MeToo shift, an absolute form of individual freedom wrapped in a protective carapace of expert management and therapeutic process. You can have a culture of hard moral constraint, a conservative order that imposes norms that initially limits human freedom, remain faithful to your chosen spouse, live in your own given body, or you can have the kind of freedom-maximizing culture which removes limits and strictures but creates new regrets, new kinds of suffering, new dangers for the vulnerable and weak. What you probably can't have is the world where Judith Butler links hands with the American Medical Association and a stable regime of permissive safety, or where ethical polyamory transforms the impulse to cheat on your spouse into a pro-social act. Or at least that world remains an undiscovered country, fervently theorized, but so far out of reach. And that's the point, the undiscovered country. We don't know the limits of the healthy or harmless sexuality, so we implicitly encourage people to go out and find them. And after you go out and find them, tell us about it. But as Jordan Peterson often notes, you don't really know truth until you actually discover an unhappy truth or something that seems that cannot be bent to your will. So most of actually the truthiness that comes out from the sexual frontier is misery. That seems to be the things we bump into. As Douthat notes on the poly space, much misery ensues. Thanks for being a sexual mountain woman. We don't really want sexual mountain men because we know what men like and do. So we want sexual mountain women. Thanks for being a sexual mountain woman. Sorry it didn't work out. Did you ever play Oregon Trail? You know how these things go. Maybe you can contribute to the frontier map so that others don't cross those lines. Or maybe it just wasn't authentic to you. More mapping needed. Ah, authentic. Keep that in mind. We'll get back to that. People very cautious of tradition will think I'm playing a game. That's implicit. Okay. But then there's the question, how are norms enforced? So in other words, we're encouraging, hopefully, people we don't really care about. They're just people out there on the internet. They're people that have written a book, and I'm sure they're getting at least some money for their book. And, you know, they tell the sad story about them and their spouse deciding that poly was a good idea until it wasn't, and then misery ensued. So the U.S. government has been trying to get out of the sex of policing, the game of policing sexuality between consenting adults for a long time. It's a thankless job in our particular culture, mostly. So in this libertarian era, it's mostly left to social shaming. Step in Andrew Huberman. Well, he didn't break any laws, but we're going to put him on a magazine and try to shame him into compliance, or at least warn all women. And it's like, do you know how silly that is? Do you absolutely know how silly that is? Post your piece in New York Mag, Andrew Huberman will have zero problems finding women to sleep with him. And how do I know this? You can reach, you can watch Home Math, you can watch dozens of channels on YouTube that basically say he's high status, he's wealthy, he's physically attractive, he's fit, he's very articulate, he knows all of the therapy speaks. That man can get laid anytime he wants. And actually, the worst thing in a lot of people's minds, the worst thing for him would be a committed relationship. However, I've known a number of men who have, in fact, maybe not been so high status, maybe not been so jacked, maybe not been so well-versed in the art of therapy speaking, who basically can already get plenty of sex on their own. And then they live that way for years or decades. And then they look at other people, perhaps chafing under the burden of monogamy, but with children and functional families and all of those things, and say, yeah, I can understand how, you know, you might, the grass seems greener on the other side, but I would trade what I have for what you have in a heartbeat. Because I would love to have children around me and have those children grow up and love me and to have an intact family and to not drive an emotional truck through my child's worldview called divorce. I'd love to do that. Oh, well, that's funny. Huberman faces no jail time, but he must be publicly labeled a cad, not a Chad. Douthit treats it well. We do prefer mountain women explorers rather than mountain men because, well, we're not quite sure. We don't trust men. Men have a back track record. We want women to be voracious as men. But because they're not strong or jacked like 40-something Andrew, they're a little less rapey. Okay, so they're safer explorers and pioneers. Now, if we ask if Huberman has violated the boundaries of the left, we'll be hesitant to say, well, yeah, and I think Douthit sort of nails it. Well, we sort of have a rough draft of, you know, maybe polyamory-ish. Just don't lie to people. Oh, okay, so we're back in Jordan Peterson land. The next reason people on the left will balk at this question is because right now the big shakeup is between the third and the first person. The recession of modernity, I say it in all kinds of different ways. While the public religion continues to invest in the monarchical vision of our map of the universe, it is not true that their personal first-person sexual map is without lines. In other words, well, maybe we can't have any lines, but we can have a compass. And you know what that compass is? Authenticity. It's our feelings. It's our authenticity compass. This is where the cult of authenticity is so valuable. There is a true me, a secret sacred self that I ought to express. And if I can get in touch with the secret sacred self, it can be my compass and it can tell me who to sleep with and who not to sleep with and when sleeping with someone was a bad idea and not sleeping with someone was a good idea. And what's more, not only is there a secret sacred self, there's a secret sacred soulmate way down in there. And I'm using my compass, my authenticity compass, to find my secret sacred soulmate. And then we'll be happy all the day, like all the Christian-y songs say. There is a true me, a secret sacred self that I ought to express, and so I have determined for myself something that no one can judge, because my view of this rather Gnostic secret sacred self is privileged. I can say gay sex isn't for me because it doesn't feel authentic to my experience. Now, I'm not going to tell anyone else what they should or shouldn't do. If they want to go pioneering in the sexual wilderness, I'll give them verbal encouragement, especially if I don't care about them a lot. If I care about them a little bit, I'll say, well, be careful, okay? Because it's a jungle out there. Just kick the theme to something else. To Monk. Now I'm going to tell anyone that they shouldn't do, so go pioneering. But for me, I have my authenticity compass, and I'm pretty cautious, and I'll probably act according to the majority standards these days. I'll sign a kind of look around and get a rough estimate of what my peer group is doing and what is working for them. It's like, wait, I thought that secret sacred self was down there. Why are you orienteering with all of your peers? It's a violation of the secret sacred self. But you don't really care because the cult of authenticity doesn't do a lot of theology, doesn't do a lot of checking, just feels authentic to me. Use contraception and only sleep with one person at a time. Unless everyone consents, I guess. I didn't think about that when I wrote the sentence. Because cheating is still a thing. We might they might be my person or my soulmate, a variant of the secret sacred self, the secret sacred soulmate. And the only way to do this, bit of personal pioneering. Hope you don't fall victim to any of the stuff on the old Oregon Trail. Now, most people aren't going around answering the question that a certain person made because, as other people said, sounds like a trap. They are loath to actually try to plot points on this hypothetical map because we leave that to the experts and the scientists to plot the points on the map, even though we're not real careful, just like with Born That Way, about actually where the experts or the scientists are. They're just, you know, we hear a little bit, we hear the politician. We're still orienting around our peer group. Now we're just using all of the screens and the media and people high up on hierarchies. They're loath to try to plot points on the hypothetical map because not all explorers have come back. Because we don't know the limits of the map. But they also don't want to be associated with hypothetically frontierlessness. People who publicly declare these lines on sexual frontier are dread conservatives. In the Radiolabs piece, it's those conservatives. There's a jungle out there, and it's filled with conservatives who want to pass laws limiting. No limits. Are there no limits? Can't say that. But we'll have you impose no limits. Well, what about, well, okay, well, maybe some limits. Well, and again, it's exactly what Douthat writes about. Here I out the group. To this, as a culture, we will tend to say, fool us once, shame on you, fool us twice. Meaning, you say that gay sex was bad, but I know gay couples, and I'm gay, or I tried your way, and the gay way, maybe with a declaration of lifelong exclusive intent, is better. See the Nick Waltersdorf speech given. I have gay friends who are pioneers. They must be believed. The same-sex pioneers of the church have gone out and tried other ways beyond the lines of the map and every turn to say it got better. So a minimum, move the line. Now, you don't want to say there are no borders because, of course, theoretically, it seems like there might be. Most of those who still want to associate with a religious tradition that wants to maintain some things like revelation will do lots of work in the Bible and write books, keeping the sunk costs of walking away from their tradition and community completely in mind. Yet the libertarian movements have really made us question the old system, and no one really wants to be labeled a bigot, so keep it fuzzy. Each of us is also impacted by the cult of authenticity. Our experience of authenticity suggests it is possible there are mappable lines, but go ahead out there, you brave pioneers, and see if you can find them. We'll be sad to read about accidents along the way, but of course we bear no responsibility for what you do on the trail because you do you. Just if you figure out that such and such is a bad thing. But of course, here's where we bump into a lot of things because, for many things, we really don't know how bad it is, probably for decades or even hundreds of years. Which again leads people back to looking at history. Oh, but they didn't have contraception, et cetera, et cetera. We'll be sad to read about the accidents along the way, but of course we bear no responsibility for what you do out on the trail. Maybe you've got a chemical, maybe you've got to chemically castrate your children, but all such frontiers are costly, of course. Authenticity will be your guide. So, well, yep. People's implicit hesitations are probably right. Things are complicated, and mappings are complicated. But I think this is part of the reason that The left really has a hard time saying, when do things go so far? And as difficult as some traditional maps might be to maintain, at least people with a traditional map sort of know where lines are. And I think for a lot of people, that's sort of leading them back to traditional maps. So there's that. Let me know what you think.